Welcome to From Idea to Impact, a podcast from Arabella Advisors that focuses on the people at the heart of our work, people who inspire us with their efforts to create positive change and impact in communities across the country and around the world.
Hi, everyone. This is Jeremy Gregg. I'm the Managing Director for Arabella Advisors based here in Dallas, Texas, and I welcome you to our podcast. Really looking forward to sharing Kelly King Jackson's story with you. I was so struck when I met Kelly and so impressed by her perspective on philanthropy. I really wanted to know more about where it came from. And we have a really wonderful, wide-ranging conversation about her background, about her teachers, and about a really important influence in her life, an English teacher named Mr. Cooley, and how that really helped inform her work today as the Vice President of Programs and Community Engagement for the Simmons Foundation in Houston, Texas. We had a conversation on Zoom, and I look forward to sharing it with you now. Thanks for joining us. Kelly, thank you so much for making time to join me today. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
It is so good to see you again after our really interesting conversation we had recently on the future of Texas. So I appreciate you joining us again to hear a bit more about you and about your story.
Thanks for the invitation. I appreciate it.
Well, I think, you know, after that last webinar, which is actually where we met, we'd had quite a few meetings leading up to that to prepare for that conversation. You know, it's so funny. You have this idea of, like, hey, let's have a conversation about a topic. And next thing you know, you have to have 10 conversations about the conversation you're going to have within this space. But those are kind of the times in which we live, you know, I think. And the thing that really struck me was both the humanity with which you approached the conversation, but also the sincerity with which you approached it. And so the reason I wanted to invite you to join us today is just to get to know a bit more about you outside of your role and at the Simmons Foundation, which is obviously really important. I would love to hear about eventually your work in philanthropy and those kinds of things, but really just want to get to know you a bit more and kind of hear about your personal journey. So there's any way you can kind of express this, but we'll just kind of know a bit more about your background, kind of really just what helped form you and helped to guide you into this amazing person that you are today.
Well, that's very kind, first of all. So thank you very much. You know, I get asked that question and I never know where to start because my journey has just always been a part of who I am. As I reflect being in my mid-40s, that this is who I was created to be. And I didn't fully know it as a child, but I was born and raised in Oakland. To a mother who is extremely passionate about education. She doesn't care about anything, didn't care about anything else when we were growing up. It was like school, education. She always had us in a program. She always had us in summer school, like anything, Parks and Rec, the suburban public school that had a science program. I'm horrible at science, but you know, I was in Mensa, how that happened, I'll never understand, but she really felt as a Black woman from the South that she wanted to give me and my brother a different opportunity. And so that led me to prep school. I left Oakland when I was about 15 or 16 years old and ended up in Northwestern Massachusetts. And in retrospect, I know I was able to do that because my mom had always had me in environments where I was one of the only brown people there. I was the only Black little girl in some of these spaces. And so I was able to have a really good sense of self in white spaces from a very early age. And I didn't have the language for it at the time, but you know, people would say, well, why would you leave Oakland to go to boarding school? Like, why would you do that? But my mom had really instilled in me, like, the world is open to you and like, don't be afraid to try. Don't be afraid of being in new spaces and trying new things. So I did prep school in Massachusetts, which was a culture and weather shock and coastal shock and all the shocks you could have. But it prepared me. And so my first social justice action that I can remember is on that prep school campus protesting. We did a silent protest during chapel because of an incident that had happened between a student of color and a white student. Mm-hmm. And we were trying to make the case that the N-word was an act of violence. And so once you do your first protest, like, you're always.
And how old were you at that moment when you helped lead your first protest?
I had been about 17.
That's amazing.
Yeah, we processed, we walked out, we had organizing meetings to prepare what we were going to do. We had signs. We ended up in the student newspaper, but the most significant outcome of that was being invited to meet with the head of school about what our experiences were as students of color on that campus. And they started making some changes that were really helpful, including a kind of campus-wide day of reading and reflection that started that year around MLK Day. And they still do it to this day, to my knowledge. And so, wow. Yeah, it was a transformative experience for sure.
Well, I know those experiences are so deeply personal, but you shared how for you, they were in a context in which was much more individual to you. I know in your LinkedIn, how you talk about that you coach women leading in white spaces. And I'd love to hear a bit more about that. It sounds like those early experiences. I mean, so you said your mom was from the South, initially grew up in Oakland, then to the other coast in Massachusetts. And in both those spaces, kind of anchored in that. And then obviously, you know, eventually we'll talk about philanthropy and as an extension of that, obviously, but would love to hear a bit more about that and how that really shaped you. And would also love if you have any thoughts around, you know, the allies you had in those moments. And when you were, you know, the one leader in that space, dealing with this, like, just would love to know more about that experience and how that still informs your work today.
Yeah. You know, prep school is a interesting place to be. I mean, I recognize I've had a lot of privilege because of education, right? Like, who goes to prep school? Who lives 3,000 miles away from home? But what I learned was that I had a voice. And I learned that very early on in my prep school class. It was sophomore English. Mr. Cooley, my favorite teacher ever, a white man who was like, I want to hear what your opinion is. And I would just regurgitate facts because that's how I had been educated, that you read the book and you say what was in the book. And he kept saying, Kelly, I don't want to hear what was in the book. I want to hear what you think. And I was like, I don't understand what you're asking me, Mr. Cooley. Like, I don't get it. Mm-hmm. And he really was helping me formulate my voice. And so I went from having a D in English my sophomore year there to getting the sophomore English award.
Wow.
And we spent so much time together, and he was really helping me find my voice and my writing. And I'd always loved to write, but this was taking me to a deeper level in how I use my words to really communicate feeling and the challenges that I was seeing in my community. And so Mr. Cooley and I are still in communication.
Oh, that's wonderful.
He's a dope dude. He changed my life. Like, I did an independent study with Mr. Cooley reading Alice Walker, Zora Neale Hurston, and Toni Morrison. Like, we have three seminal books by Black women with this old white guy from Northwestern Massachusetts. And it was amazing.
Well, you know, I'd love to dig more into that particular relationship. I know in my life, that man was Dr. Tom Pruitt, who was also an English teacher, who kind of grabbed me literally by the back of the neck and helped me see that, you know, you have a brain in here and I need you to use it. I would love to dig more into that particular relationship, especially in a dynamic in which there were so many differences in some ways between the two of you. How did he handle that in a way that worked? And not to call on anyone by name, although you're welcome to, I'm sure there were other experiences which were not in that that favorable people in power where they were the opposite in terms of your voice. Would love to just kind of know more about that particular dynamic and maybe how that resonated so much with you.
Yeah, I mean, the first thing is he had a love and a respect for Black literature. So it was never seen as like something separate, right? So Shakespeare wasn't lifted up and then these were other things we were adding into curriculum. He really centered multiple voices. And so to have a white teacher to do that really gave me a lot of agency at that age to be like, oh yeah, like this is not an aside, like this is who we are as humanity. And Mr. Cooley was just like a fun person to be around in terms of like, he was really curious and he was really good about history. And so I could never get past like the first few pages of Beloved because of all these historical references. And we went through them line by line on that first page, all of the things that were happening during the war, what was happening around slavery, like really helping me understand the stage that Toni Morrison was setting. That's my favorite book, right? And I was writing this paper about, as a Black mother, the choice to kill your child rather than have them return to this place of dehumanizing their existence and the complexity of that. So to be able to do that at 17 was because of that support and the way that he viewed the world.
And I'm sure that played a huge role into why you felt capable of organizing your fellow students in that protest and then having your own strong voice there. That's really profound. Was that more rare than the typical experience in terms of how teachers relate to you and your experience?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, my traditional schooling experience before going to prep school was very much a rote kind of memorize, learn the thing, spew it out. And so there wasn't that human connection in the way. Like I had really nice teachers. Some I'm still in contact with, Sister Spaniard, because my mom had me in Catholic school before I transitioned out of Oakland. But, you know, people who were still a part of my life and really cared for me. I had a great English teacher in middle school. It was also, I think, the proximity of being in prep school. So prep school takes away that this is what we do at school and this is how we live our life. People who teach at prep school, at boarding school specifically, say, my teaching is my life and my life is my teaching. And so how my instructors showed up in that space was that they were always available to me, right? There was no separation between personal and professional in the ways that traditional school. So I got to see my teachers as human. I got to see my teachers having kids have tantrums or going through a divorce or all the things, right? And it wasn't shielded. And so I think it also brought a level of maturity and nuance into who our teachers were. So that was helpful.
Wow. Well, you know, I'm curious to know. I mean, I had no idea what Flampy was when I was 17. Wondering if you, kind of looking back now, began to see the roots of where you are today forming then, and kind of how I know you eventually, you know, your path led you to NYU and then eventually to UCLA. And just wondering, like, back to those formative high school years. For those of us who have the wonderful privilege of raising teenagers, as we think about these formative moments, how did those days shape who you are today and in your work today at the Simmons Foundation?
Yeah. So the boarding school I went to had a philosophy from the founder about the head, the heart, and the hand. And so we had a lot of students who were on financial assistance, including myself, right? So philanthropy was always a part of my education because I was always on some kind of scholarship. But it also was trying to teach us that we all had to have a level of humility. So no matter if your parent was a diplomat or a famous entertainer, and I went to school with all of those folks, we all did chores. Because the hand was about, you need to do labor, right? So we all had chores. And you couldn't pay someone to do your chores all the time, right? You had a couple wiggle rooms there, but they were really trying to say, like, no one is above someone else. We all contribute to this community. I think that has a lot to do with the spirit of giving and philanthropy and having that lived experience of both receiving support, but also like helping to maintain something. That experience definitely influenced that.
Well, I'm curious, kind of after school, like I mentioned some of the schools you went to, how did you then shape in your early adulthood? Kind of what was that experience like before you started your career as you were in college and all that?
I had no idea what I was doing. I think once I got to prep school, like my mom didn't have these educational experiences. So she was basically, she talked to everyone, she'd ask questions, and then she would sign us up for something. But once I got to prep school, it's like, where do you go from here, right? And so it was my college counselors and people who were trying to help me navigate. honestly, I met friends from New York, and the first time I went to New York City, I was like, I'm going to college in New York because this is a lot of fun. And I'd lived on a in a dorm, I'd lived on a campus, and I didn't want to do it again. And so again, a lot of agency at a very young age to be able to say, this is what I want, and this is what I'm going to go after. And it wasn't easy, but NYU was the best decision I made. So I loved every moment of it, for sure.
Well, that's wonderful that that age has such a clear sense of identity, and what a gift from your mom and from your school and your peers and those teachers. Because you went right into this sort of work after school, didn't you?
I did. Because I couldn't afford to pay NYU lovely tuition, I had some Black women who I was doing work study for who knew my mom was really struggling financially and who were like, if you worked here as an employee, you could get tuition reimbursement. I had no idea what that was, but these Black women coached me through the interview prep, through what I should wear. And they're like, you're already doing this job as a work study. You could totally get this job. And so at 19, 20, I interviewed for a full-time job at NYU, got the job, and I was able to continue my education because these women had mentored me and taken me under their wing and helped me feel confident enough at that age to get a salaried job that was making $23,712. I don't think I'll ever forget that number because I thought I was making big money. But the best part was I had tuition credit. And so I was like the only young person who was going to school at night because it wasn't common back then. So I was in class with 40-year-olds who had whole families, right? But I went to work 9 to 5 and I went to school from 6 to 9 every night until I finished my undergrad.
You know, a couple of times, and thank you for sharing that, but a couple of times you've mentioned other people who played a really critical role outside of obviously your mom within that space. To what extent has that really guided you? I mean, just looking through your career, I mean, obviously you have your career, but in your own coaching work and all this, I mean, talk about the role of other people, maybe how that guides some of your work today, because the way you described philanthropy to me and your approach to it was not writing checks to distant organizations and then having them send in their reports. It was very personal. Just would love to know more about that and how that really formed you, these other folks, whether it's Mr. Cooley or the women who coached you into these jobs.
I don't believe I do anything alone. None of what I've accomplished has been because I'm exceptional. I have adult children and we talk a lot about like not buying into this myth of exceptionalism and that we somehow got where we were only because we work hard. Yes, I absolutely work hard and I've had a lot of support and my support has been in mentors and teachers in amazing humans who love me and like cheer me on and call me in when they see me struggling. And that is why I'm able to do my work the way that I do it. So I don't see philanthropy as a transaction of a check going to an organization. I really see it as my job is to build a relationship and to really understand what's happening in community and then help my board to understand why this is an investment that they should be making into our ecosystem of groups who are trying to bring justice into Houston.
So speaking to your current job, you can just tell us a little bit about what you guys are doing. I know you have a pretty large portfolio you're managing, and with your perspective, that doesn't lend itself towards easy work and kind of quickly checking these boxes. But for our listeners who aren't as familiar with your foundation, can you kind of give them a quick overview of who you guys are, what you guys are doing, maybe if there's a particular focus areas to your work, and some sense of kind of the nature of your work before we can kind of get into the philosophy that's driving you behind it.
Absolutely. So I work with the Simmons Foundation and we are a regional grant maker. So we fund in the greater Houston area and we have made a commitment to funding around social justice issues. So we fund in reproductive justice, we fund in immigration, we fund in gender justice, we fund in youth justice, which is youth who've been impacted by the criminal justice, child welfare, immigration, and school discipline systems. We fund around community power building, which is really trying to get resources into the hands of local communities who are trying to build the communities that they want to see for themselves and for their families. And we do that work with a small budget, right? We're not a big dollar funder.
Yeah.
But what we are is a big thought funder. So we really cultivate relationships with folks and really try to let them make sure we're honoring the work that they do and how we do our grant making.
Well, any one of those issues itself could easily occupy your entire grant budget, especially when you bring a justice lens to them, because then you get to root causes and all the social determinants of the issues behind. And so lacking potentially the billions of dollars, and speaking maybe to some of your peers out there who are in similar spots in terms of their grant size and their budget, how do you establish that? What does it look like to be a to be in that space with that and digging into those issues, particularly when you have the orientation of being a partner and a collaborator with your grantees, which can be a wonderful and at times exhausting approach, kind of digging right into the issues and really encountering the limitations of budgets and those issues. How do you approach that?
With a lot of humility. I work in a very white industry that got its wealth from very harmful things, right? So we can't come into partnership with folks and act like we are not also part of the problem that our communities are facing. So we have to have a lot of humility and really name the thing, right? So I say partner, but can I ever really partner with an organization when I'm seen as holding the power, if you will, in the relationship, right? Like, I have to have a lot of humility and be really honest about how difficult it is to cultivate a partnership with a funder, right? It's difficult to tell a funder the truth if you're afraid that there will be things held against you or some unknown ramification. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't try to do our best to be better in our grant making. And so that's what we do. Like, we really just say, like, we don't have it all figured out. We don't have all the answers, but we are really committed to trying to do this work from a place of acknowledging the harm that philanthropy has caused and how can we do better in getting the resources out to the communities that are most impacted by the social issues that we care about.
Well, you know, as we record this, spring is merging in Texas after a very, very challenging year that began a year ago. Challenging is obviously a dramatically incorrect word, inaccurate word. Wondering, as you bring this perspective, I mean, you guys, it seems like you particularly have always had this orientation, your foundation has. Are there changes that you're seeing in the sector, whether it's in Texas or across the philanthropic sector at all in this way of, I mean, we've emerged in this really challenging year that's revealed the role of philanthropy and the limitations of what philanthropy can do. Are you seeing your peers changing in this direction at all?
Ooh, Jeremy. That's a hard question. I am concerned that all of us, and I don't only speak to philanthropy, are so traumatized and exhausted about this last year that we actually want to go back to normal. Even though we all know normal was not working for us, right? I think it's human nature to go back to what is comfortable and known after this type of trauma. I don't think it's in our best interest to do that. I think that we need to keep doing streamlined grant making. I think we need to continue to fund direct cash assistance. I think we need to continue to fund the small grassroots groups who helped us access folks during COVID that we should have already and always been funding. Like, I think we need to stick with that. And we have been trying to do a lot of what we call philanthropic advocacy. Mm-hmm. So really trying to get these organizations in front of peers who don't always think about their work in the same ways as their named portfolios and really trying to connect some of those dots through our relationships with other funders.
Well, you know, one of the things that we talked about in our last conversation is that you mentioned this earlier in today's conversation, is that the nature of philanthropy itself comes from a place of privilege. And how can you, as a leader in that space, coming obviously from a place of privilege, really truly understand the challenges and the oppression of the people that you seek to serve? And that can be done so poorly. Would love kind of your thoughts on on that in particular. And I know this can be a thorny issue, but you're unfortunately have a bit of a rare perspective. And you mentioned, as a Black woman leading in a very white space, you're frequently speaking to people who look like me in our work. Mm-hmm. Would love just your advice, might be the wrong word, but just your perspective on this. Like, what can philanthropy do, and what can philanthropists really do in that space with integrity? Because I think you're right. I think there's an exhaustion from this. I think there's desire for people to want to go back to the way, you know, it was a lot easier to write nice checks to nice organizations and call it a day. But would just love your thoughts on this. You know, philanthropy is at this moment where we can really confront this. It's about the year anniversary of Mr. Floyd's murder. And, you know, just what can we do next? How do we not give up?
Yeah. I think the first thing that we could do is always name the thing, right? So we need to name where we are as philanthropy and to be honest about that with our partners. I just got off of a call with our grant partners to give them some updates about our budget and our process. And I think having the courage, because I think in our sector, it is considered having the courage to be honest and transparent about where we are as organizations helps organizations to plan, right? So I think that that's really important. I think the other piece is to not be afraid to be vulnerable with our grant partners. And it's hard because most program staff are caught between their board and their grant partners, right? And program staff have a unique job of balancing the relationship between those two entities. And I think that program staff at foundations are uniquely burnt out, and we don't always think about that, even though they're sitting in jobs of privilege. I think as program staff, also holding that I too sit from a place of privilege, right? I no longer experience the need for a scholarship, right? So there are certain things I can no longer relate to. I could have related to it 30 years ago, but I can't relate to it now. And so I question, am I the best person to lead in this work? And have really been sitting with that. And what does my future look like in terms of, should people like me be the ones making the decisions about where resources go? And I'm leaning towards no. I'm leaning towards the decisions about how these resources are spent should really be left to the hands of the community. But that's going to require a lot of work with very powerful, very wealthy people who are used to driving the conversation and making decisions about what solutions need to be uplifted and what solutions are fundable and what solutions are sustainable, and what solutions are scalable, and all these big words that quite honestly have not ended the thing that we said we wanted to solve. So clearly we don't know all the things. So I don't think that there is harm in trying to do it a different way. And I hope that there are more and more funders who are willing to begin to have those conversations.
Well, I know there's been some interesting conversations around this idea of participatory grant making, you know, and where you're actually entrusting the decision making for the funding over to those who are going to be most affected by those decisions. And I know sharing power can be really difficult in philanthropy in particular. And I want to go back to a comment you mentioned about how we are afraid in some ways in this space. And I'd love your thoughts. Where do you think that fear comes from? When you're an endowed foundation and you don't have to worry about revenues or customers, why have fear? Where does that come from?
I mean, we have white corporate mentality about returns on investment, right? There's never going to be a return on investment for money that was generated off of the backs of the people who are still in material conditions that are challenging, right? So the myths that we lift up in philanthropy about ROI or impact, I think are so steeped in whiteness that we have to unpack those. And as a person, as a Black woman, I too came into this work believing in a lot of those things, right? And so I think we need to be in better relationship with understanding how we think about what is success. And to be honest, that $1 million, $5 million, $20 million is not going to end systemic racism. It's not going to end misogyny, right? And so we need to kind of get out of our own head and way, so that we can see the truth about our industry and what solutions we can actually bring to the table. Mm. So I think we all want to continue to work towards ending those things, but we need to be honest and not expect to hold grant partners to this myth that they're going to end something with the amount of money that we give, because what we're giving is not sufficient for 500 years of torture and oppression. It's just not.
So I want to ask another contentious question, kind of on the other side. So you're the program officer. Your relationship to grantees is one thing. Talk about the relationship to the board. Because there's these boards, you know, we have about $1 trillion in assets under management by foundations in the country right now. And 5% of that or so is granted out per year. The vast majority is invested in a year, as you mentioned, with the sort of mentality that can be problematic for this. And that mentality fundamentally comes from the board. How can a program officer affect some of that? You clearly have a board that supports you and endorses you in most of your work, I'm sure. But would love to know, speak to your fellow program staff out there who feel that pain of they want to do this, but the board will never be behind this. What's that dynamic look like, and how can that be shifted?
So my CEO, when I came into this work, really taught me that we have to stop acting like we don't have more power than we do have. So I'm not the final decision maker at my foundation. So I'll talk about boards in a second, but there is a level of power that I have. And I've had to learn how to use that power to get groups in the door that wouldn't normally on paper look like they fit on the door. And so the way that I train staff that I supervise, it is that it is our job as program staff to translate the work of grant partners into a language that our board can understand. It's not the job of the grant partner to translate their work for us. It's our job to translate their work for our board, because we speak that language, right? And so we've really tried to take a lot of that labor off of the grant partners and put it onto the program staff where we feel it's really more appropriate. So our grant partner might be doing social determinants of health work, but they don't use that language. Why would they? Why would they use that language? It's my job as a program staff to explain how the work of the grant partner is social determinants of health, right? But I think so many program staff have bought into this myth of neutrality and like they got to be neutral. That's not even real, because most of grant making is based off relationships. So we should also be telling the truth about how these things really work. So I'd say that we have much more power that we need to be leveraging as program staff, and holding space for program staff being really exhausted and sometimes feeling really defeated that the work that they're trying to move forward, their board doesn't understand and won't approve. And to that, I say, it is time for philanthropy to start looking at their board problem. We have a board problem at the Simmons Foundation. All of us need to be looking at who is sitting on our boards. How do we make our boards more representative of people who are most impacted? How do we sit with the discomfort around that? How do we sit with the discomfort of having non-family members on family boards? How do we look at the discomfort of dynamics between these kind of advisory boards that are really popular and the board of directors, and really impacting power there? Because if we don't change boards across philanthropy, I fear that we're not going to make the progress that we could be making, particularly in this moment in time.
Well, Kelly, I feel like we could just talk all day about some of these things. I so appreciate the authenticity and the humanity with which you approach this. This is clearly a vocation for you and not just a place of employment and a thing to do. But as we kind of wrap up, and I really appreciate what you just shared, I would love to hear your vision for philanthropy in the next, let's say, 5 to 10 years. What are some of the things that you would love to see philanthropy itself take on as we kind of wrap up this conversation with a, whether that's a challenge to your peers who are listening to this or what this could be? We'd love to just see your vision for philanthropy itself in the context of all the challenges that we're facing as a society.
I mean, first, my motto has been hashtag free the coin, right? Like, release the money. I think that's the first thing. We shouldn't have organizations led by Black LGBTQ folks or undocumented immigrants who don't have the resources to be fully staffed and provide benefits to their staff, right? So we need to release the money so that we can sustain the work that's already in the community. We need to have more community-driven decision-making around how money is put out into the community. We need to have more fund managers of color, of diverse experience, of diverse ways of thinking, who are a part of investing the resources. We need to, again, diversify our boards. We need to streamline our process. We need to fund multi-year grants. We need to fund general operating. There is so much that we can be doing. And I think we, as foundations, we need to hold ourselves accountable for having tangible commitments we're going to make, ways of measuring that commitment and those and the progress toward those commitments, and ways of holding ourselves accountable to the communities that we serve. We can do that. And I call us into a conversation about how we get that done.
Well, Kelly, thank you for joining me in this hopefully first of several conversations we'll have over the coming years about how to hashtag free the coin and to advance philanthropy in that space. So Kelly King Jackson, thank you so much for making time for us today.
Thanks for having me. It was great talking to you.
Thank you for listening to From Idea to Impact. To learn more about the guests featured on this podcast and the work we do at Arabella Advisors, please visit our website at www.arabellaadvisors.com.